Fellow Center Church, very happy to be with you again for another week as we continue with our series on the parables of Jesus. I think we're now in our second two-parter. We won't be able to address this parable in only 1 week, so we're at least going to take 2 weeks to look at it. And in fact, they're partner parables. They're working in conjunction with one another. Today, we're only looking at one of the two. And that is the parable of the contemptible friend and the corrupt judge. And the corrupt judge, or the unjust judge, is really going to be the centerpiece, and we'll use its companion parable, the parable of the contemptible friend, more next week. But we'll see that as essentially a supplement to the parable we're looking at today. So let's take a look at the parable of the unjust or the corrupt judge. And this shows up in Luke chapter 18, verses 1 through 8. And he told them a parable on the necessity of their always praying and not becoming remiss, saying, "In a certain city there was a certain judge who did not fear God and who had no concern for humankind. And there was a widow in that city, and she came to him, saying, 'Grant me justice over against my adversary.' And for some time he would not. But thereafter he said within himself, 'Though indeed I do not fear God, nor do I have any concern for humankind, I shall grant her justice simply because she bothers me, for fear that at the last she will entirely exhaust me with her visits.' And the Lord said, 'Listen to what the unjust judge says. Will not God then surely bring about justice for his chosen ones, crying to him day and night, and not delay over them for long? I tell you, he will swiftly bring them justice. Yet, when the Son of Man comes, will he then find faith on the earth?'" So, not only do we have the parable presented, but we, immediately following the parable, have Luke's framing of the message. Of its meaning, or at least a primary meaning. We have Jesus saying in Luke's chapter 18, "And the Lord said, 'Listen to what the unjust judge says. Will not God then surely bring about justice for his chosen ones, crying to him day and night, and not delay over them for long? I tell you, he will swiftly bring them justice. Yet, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth?'" And so we have this interpretive layer from Jesus in Luke's account. And it's certainly very helpful in making meaning of the entire parable. And it also follows a tradition within rabbinic teaching, where one moves from the lesser to the greater. So, and we'll look at this more, but it's a fairly straightforward concept. If even an unjust judge does something that is good or just, how much more should we expect of God our Father? So this stylistic tactic would have been something that would have been familiar to the listeners in the time of Christ, and will be useful for us in our analysis of the parable. As far as my research has taken me, it seems that there are at minimum three significant layers of meaning to this parable, and I'm not sure. They include many complementary insights. However, at each layer of analysis, I don't know that they fit perfectly together. And as I have done through, as I've said throughout this series thus far, I would encourage you to analyze the parable yourself and wrestle with its potential implications. Here are the layers of meaning that I've identified. The first we'll look at today. The final two we'll look at next week. So the first layer of meaning is a sociological and anthropological commentary. At the first pass of this parable, which is very rich, I think we have sociological and anthropological insights at work. So we're learning something in this parable through these characters about the ways in which society works, and its flaws. It is certainly a critique, as well as something about human nature and our tendencies to think about one another in particular and often unfair or unproductive ways. So, one, sociological and anthropological commentary. That's this week. Two, this is a commentary on authentic faith and prayer. And finally, three, a commentary on what God is like. And I really do believe that as we move through these layers of meaning, I think their impact becomes richer. In other words, if you understand this parable only at the first layer of meaning, as a sociological and anthropological commentary, it will be useful to you. It has the potential to shape how you interact with others and parts of our society. But if you can apprehend the second layer of meaning, and even then the third layer of meaning, the potential for, I think, greater impact or value increases markedly. So, and this is merely my treatment. There's so much rich thinking on this in scholarship, which I know some of you pursue. So today, the sociological and anthropological commentary. Let's talk about two lesser approaches that are well known, well regarded, and they're prevalent. It's worth taking the time to address these and maybe not debunk them, but hopefully move them down the hierarchy of value as we're trying to understand what these parables might be about. So the first we'll look at is an analysis by the German Lutheran scholar Joachim Jeremias. And I know that many of you have been waiting a very long time for me to criticize his work. Jeremias offers an eschatological approach to this parable. He arrives at the conclusion because of Luke 18:8, when the Son of Man comes, he will find faith on earth. So he takes that frame and it essentially defines his understanding of the parable. Now the parable has something to do with the realized Messiah, with Jesus' return, with perseverance for Christians, and really, like, one could understand how he would arrive at that. However, even though that may be a popular understanding, it doesn't really comport with the parable itself. The widow is not receiving judgment. Rather, it would be her adversary who does. We don't have that at all in the parable. The parable is much more open than that. We're left expecting something, but we don't see a judgment rendered. And this adversary is, interestingly, not only not featured, but we don't really know anything about the adversary of the widow. And so this interpretation, this eschatological interpretation, which insists on understanding it through the filter of the return of Christ, I think is really not the approach to take. And it also fails at another level. We would expect the listeners of the time, yes, to be puzzled by it, yes, to be frustrated by it, but not mystified in the sense that they cannot make meaning of it. The challenge of the parables of Jesus is that by working through them, you do eventually gain layer after layer of insight. And I don't know that that would have been available under that reading. Another lesser approach, there's one. We're going to touch on two very quickly. Another is by a scholar that I've enjoyed for a very long time, the late Kenneth Bailey, who does some really interesting and I think very important work on Paul. But Bailey's argument is essentially that the avoidance, essentially that this parable is about essentially shame culture and or rather honor shame culture, and that the avoidance of shame is essentially the driving thesis of the parable. So he arrives at this through his analysis of the honor shame culture of the Middle East. And while it's true that the Middle East was concerned with honor shame in a way that other cultures are, but ours isn't necessarily, really isn't at all, it may be painting with too broad a brush, and I think it begins to fail at that level. We should remember the culture of the Middle East was very diverse, was heavily influenced by many schools of thought, not least of which include Greco-Roman thought. And I just don't see the avoidance of shame as either a centerpiece or even really a side note in the parable of the corrupt judge or the co-opted judge. And so I think that as much as I appreciate Bailey in other regards, I think that his treatment fails. Even when the judge grants the widow's request, gives her a hearing, it isn't out of, I don't have any sense of this being about honor shame. We'll talk about the language used of the widow when she essentially threatens the judge with some kind of violence or attack. And so I suppose you could build honor shame into that. I don't really think that it's there. I think it requires, it's just a bit of a stretch. So there are two approaches that it's entirely possible our center communities, as I'm talking about these two, have heard nothing of them. But if you look into this parable, the parable of the corrupt judge, if you look into this parable, you're going to stumble across these very quickly in some form or another. I don't think those are the approaches we want to take today. So again, we'll look at the first layer of meaning today, and that is one that takes place at the sociological and anthropological level. And to get to that, to get to, I think, what is a better reading of this parable, let's begin with the question of what the widow actually wants. What do we make of the drivers of the widow and her desired outcomes? So what does the widow want? First, the widow is not technically seeking justice. The word used is not dikaiosyne, rather, which is a Greek word that is prevalent throughout the New Testament, and that would be the word used if we are dealing merely or simply with a desire or need for justice on her part. It doesn't necessarily mean the word that is used is a negative word. It is potentially a positive word that's used. Whatever the widow is seeking is potentially positive. Maybe it's more like a neutral word, and the better translation, and really the undisputed translation, is that the widow is seeking to be avenged. She's seeking vengeance. So I want to be careful because I don't want to be misleading with giving you those two words. There's a reason that translators will often give us the word justice, even though the Greek that stands behind that is it would not lend itself to the word justice. In a courtroom setting, in the legal judicial system of the ancient Near East, this kind of word, something around vengeance or to be avenged, would be a word that would be used, and it wouldn't necessarily carry with it negative connotations. I don't think it necessarily carries with it negative connotations today, even though I imagine that some number out of 10, if they hear something like "you're seeking vengeance," you know, that's not a particularly positive sounding frame. But at minimum, we need to distinguish what actually the widow wants here. And this is far more neutral. At best, it's far more neutral than the text on its face seems to be. So to explore the word vengeance, I mean, this is the kind of thing that is executed. The same language, same idea is used when we step back into the Hebrew language, this is what is executed on Israel's firstborn sons. This is the kind of word that is used when we see the warfare that we see in Numbers, for example. This is this kind of vengeance being avenged. This construct shows up when Samson goes against the Philistines. It may not be necessarily negative, but this is not a word that seems bloodless. And that is an important point. We don't have to make the case that the word is always or exclusively negative. And I think that's where we have room for a word like justice in the parable. But I don't know that justice gets the sense of what the widow is seeking. This is a very strong bit of language that, when you observe its use across the Bible, throughout the Bible, it's something that is quite personal. There's a sense of the widow seeking punishment here. It doesn't strike me in the same way that her seeking after justice strikes me. There's something very personal about this, and I don't think there might be a bit of eisegesis happening. There might be a bit of me reading into the text there, but I don't think it's an unfair reading. So what will the widow do? What will she do to provoke the outcome that she wants? Let's look at this once more. We're in chapter 18. In a certain city, there was a certain judge who did not fear God and who had no concern for humankind. I mean, I'm not a fan of the judge at this point either. And there was a widow in that city, and she came to him saying, "Grant me justice." Perhaps a more accurate translation of this would be, "Grant me vengeance. Avenge me over against my adversary." And for some time he would not. But thereafter he said within himself, "Though indeed I do not fear God, nor do I have any concern for humankind, I shall grant her justice simply because she bothers me, for fear that at the last she will entirely exhaust me with her visits." So again, we have some language that is hiding, I think, the extreme nature. And remember, Jesus is telling these parables to shock. He's telling these parables to provoke and to challenge. We have something that's hiding, I think, the extreme tone of this parable. The language where in my text it translates "exhaust me with her visits" actually is a boxing term. And while I don't think there is some conversation about whether or not this means actual violence. I don't really see it that way. I don't really think she plans to strike him in the face. But again, the metaphor is quite clear. She is going to make an issue out of this in a way that is very hostile. This is something that is personal. It's not so much that she's going to wear the judge down, the uninterested judge, the judge who doesn't fear God or care about his fellow man. She is on a mission. And whatever she plans to do to the judge, even if it's not an actual black eye, it is something that is going to cut him to the quick. And there's a threat here, and that's lost in many of these translations. But there's something very intense here. Her behavior, the power of her character, causes us to question. And this is I think where the parable begins to get interesting. Really, the way she's behaving causes us to question exactly who serves as the protagonist and exactly who in this story, if anyone, should receive our sympathy. I mean, we are already primed when we begin the parable. It's the parable of the corrupt judge. And we now have the main player. Our sympathies, and we'll explore this more, already lie with the widow. But these primers may not be to our benefit when we're trying to understand how Jesus is provoking with this story. I'll rewind to emphasize again. This is a lesser to greater motif, approach, an approach within the parable, within the style of communicating and challenging. There is certainly a lesser to greater theme here, and that remains. But the provocativeness, the challenge of the parable, I think, lies elsewhere. So at a literary level, widows carry symbolic power even today. I mean, it's one of those kinds of images or symbols that really doesn't need much translation. Sometimes widows are the ones who are most in need of protection. And in fact, there's no reason to abandon what is an obvious literary symbol that holds up in many ways across culture and time. There's something to this. The Bible tells us in Exodus 22, we're not to abuse widows. God brings justice for the widow and the orphan in Deuteronomy 10 and Deuteronomy 27. Isaiah says that they should be advocated for, and Jeremiah insists that they must be protected from oppression and says it in the starkest of ways in Jeremiah 22. I mean, the Bible, Hebrew Bible, New Testament, the Bible advocates for the care of those who are oppressed and those who are in need. This analysis is not attempting to abandon that larger principle, but it will challenge it, and in some ways it will subvert it, even while not entirely leaving it behind. And here's a question that I think is essential to understanding our first layer of meaning. Is it the case that to know one widow is to know them all? And I am so intrigued by Jesus as a teacher. There's something about these teachings. He's too, like, it's beyond clever. It is a work of genius, the things he says and does and the ways he twists and turns stories. Is to know one widow essentially to know them all? I don't think Jesus allows us to say yes to that. Again, there is something to be said for this kind of symbolic power of the language of the widow, right? But Jesus is exactly aware of that. He understands that precisely, and that is why I think we have a widow who is wanting, she is not floating into the courtroom on the clouds, and she is wanting, you might say she's wanting a form of justice, but if you say that, you have to understand that kind of in a semantic way, like that justice looks a lot like vengeance. And the judge, we'll get to the judge, but whatever you might say about the judge, this widow, this person most in need of protection, goes the trope, is out for blood, and she is insistent, and she is using the language of like boxing and violence against the judge, even if not understood literally, should be taken seriously. So Jesus is provoking these questions. As I'm reading this, I'm thinking to myself, okay, so, you know, it's to know one widow to know them all. This widow has a sharp tongue. This widow is quite stubborn. By the way, we don't really have the time to get into it in this discussion or teaching, but you should look at the parallel between Elijah and the widow in 1 Kings 17. There's a very interesting parallel between this parable and the story of Elijah and a widow in 1 Kings 17, where you have a widow who is quite obstinate, who breaks kind of our notions of what a widow is. So this widow, sharp tongue, insistent and stubborn. We don't know, by the way, her economic status, and that's important. We don't even know what she wants, which is also really important. She's saying she wants vengeance. She wants to be avenged. What does she want? What does she want to happen to her adversary? Do we assume? I mean, is it right to assume that she wants money or compensation from her adversary? We don't know this. We simply don't know. Rabbinic law could prevent. It's true that rabbinic law could prevent widows from inheriting wealth in certain cases, but they could receive bequests of property. But regardless, she says nothing of she says nothing of being in poverty. She clearly has access to the court, which reflects some agency. There's a very interesting and potential connection to another woman in Luke chapter 7, verse 37. This unnamed woman not only has wealth and also is in an unnamed city, but she also exhibits the tenacity to get the thing that she wants. In Luke, Jesus warns to beware of scribes who devour widows' homes, which you might argue plays into kind of the trope or the symbol of the weak widow. However, they have houses in the first place. But who knows? I don't really have to make the case that the widow in the parable is wealthy, or that the widow in the parable is seeking capital punishment as opposed to something else. The point is what we presume about the widow before we know about the widow. What we will presume about the widow in spite of all of the clues to the contrary. So at minimum, as we are thinking about the widow, I hope that I've laid some groundwork and made the case that we should at least remain open about the character of this player in the story. Let's talk about the judge for a moment. Again, we encounter this rabbinic literary technique where we move from the light to heavy. If even an unjust judge does good for a widow, how much more good will God do for us? And again, yes to this. We'll explore this. But more interesting things, I think, are happening here. And Levine is particularly useful here. Here is her framing. Is he unjust by denying the widow, she asks, or is his injustice because he grants her what she wants? Judges and the system they represent are not viewed terribly favorably in the New Testament. So, what an interesting take on an intentionally very open and quite ambiguous parable. We know that there is something about the judge that is off-putting, and it's not a mystery. Not only does he not fear God, but also he doesn't care for humankind. He doesn't care for people, and he's a judge. He's found himself in a position of rendering justice for people, the very people that he's entirely apathetic toward. This is not a character that's easy to love or a character that should be loved. However, the idea that his unjust act is to resist the widow is a presumption on our part. And we have a picture of the role of judges in the New Testament that's worth exploring. It's not clear. There's some complexity here. We know that we are given the image of God as a judge. We know that there are judgments that are, to go back to a previous critique, eschatological. We know that rendering judgment is in part an exercise in wisdom about essentially dividing what is good and not good, about developing an ethical compass that process employs judgment, but it's not as clean as that. Judges, and this is where I think we're beginning to get at our primary thesis, this first layer of analysis. Judges and, again, at a symbolic level, judges and the system they represent are not viewed favorably in the New Testament. Jesus refuses the role of judge, Luke 12. He talks about the threat such a system, the system in which the system that the judges inhabit. He talks about the threat this kind of system and its players and its stakeholders represent to the common man, represent to the everyday person. That's also in Luke 12. When the courts are encountered in Luke and Acts, people pay very high prices, and it tends not to work out for them. Evidence of this is really all over Luke and Acts. See Luke 11, 19, see Acts 10 and Acts 18. And we could look at each of those passages, but again, time, I think, prohibits that. But by way of summary, avoid the courts. It's a bloody place, and people are out there in the system seeking vengeance. They are relentless. It is personal. And the Bible, particularly when we think of the courts at the level of at a societal level, makes clear it probably won't go well. So sociologically, anthropologically, what's the comment here? What's the insight? Where's the provocation? I think that it relies in the strange ambiguity and openness in the parable, an ambiguity and an openness that allows the reader to see the stereotypes they develop, the stereotypes they already have as they encounter the parable. And I should add one caveat. Obviously, I'm not trying to make the point that we should ignore the needs of poor and powerless widows, or ignore the needs of anyone that has been. Some of you are marking out the note you've taken. Ignore the widow. That's not the message here. Nor should we ignore the needs of anyone who has been placed on the outside of a society or who has been marginalized in one way or another. That's clearly not what's going on in the text. But the text is fundamentally provoking by shoving our faces into the stereotypes that we build. And stereotypes have, for many reasons, which we'll now discuss, have many pitfalls that are problematic for the person who adopts the stereotype. They are problematic for those who are the target of the object of the stereotyping, and problematic for the society as a whole. So here are two points, only two, essentially by way of bringing this all together. First, prioritize the individual over their affiliations. Prioritize the individual over their affiliations. For those of you who are in center communities and you have listened to this prior and maybe even had discussion around the parable before my analysis, I would be very interested in if any community would do this. I imagine it would honestly be ours. I would be very interested to know what you had to say about the widow and how you viewed the widow before some of this content was unpacked. And maybe your view hasn't changed. But I think I love what Jesus is doing here as a teacher. He knows all of the, understandably, all of the assumptions that people bring to the table when you hear the word widow. He knows this. And how does he frame the widow? Again, somebody who is seeking vengeance, somebody who is out for blood, somebody who wants punishment to be rendered. Somebody who is willing to be persistent. We're going to talk about the good features of the widow as well. We'll address some of those things next week. But we're getting, as opposed to somebody who's willing to, in some way, poses a threat to the judge. His reputation, his patience, his physical well-being, even though, as I said, I don't quite read it that way. What we're getting, instead of the stereotype, instead of the trope, we're getting a complex, something more complex, and that reveals tremendous cleverness on Jesus' part. Prioritize the individual over their affiliations. And this is a very complex task, easier said than done. And I think the reason I want to explore the implications of a statement like that, prioritize the individual over their affiliations, I think the reason this is such a complex task is largely due to the fact that there is real utility in analyzing societal problems and the potential solutions to those problems by examining how people are treated in the aggregate. Anybody who's taken a stats class knows this. It's useful to think about how people are treated not only as individuals, but also as communities of various kinds. And it allows us to think about big and complex problems in ways that might allow us to render more effective solutions. So clearly there's something valuable in thinking about the role of groups of people. And so that's why I think this parable is so fundamentally challenging. We know there's something very useful about thinking about people in groups and considering how they are treated and valued or mistreated and wrongly valued as groups. However, there is obviously value, and I would say it's necessary to engage with people inside of and outside of our tribes. I would say it's necessary to engage them as individuals, as opposed to clusters of interlocking or complementary ideologies. And in some ways, it feels obvious, and maybe it is, but I think actually it provokes far more than that. Imagine that you're engaging someone who you know. Someone who you know offers their allegiance to a political value that you see as dehumanizing, as unhealthy for society, detrimental for society. If you engage them merely on the level of ideology, it's quite possible you'll never really understand the complexity of what caused them to arrive at the position they now hold. And that's what's so fascinating about how individuals organize themselves into groups. And that's why it's a complex, I think, challenge that Jesus is offering as he's insisting we dismantle, seek to identify and dismantle our stereotypes. Of course, the affiliations that you have and the ideologies that you promote reflect something about who you are. But I see this parable as challenging the idea that these affiliations, whatever they might be, are necessary to who you are. And please hear this, because I think it's to me, this is an important a key pillar in my thesis that I've arrived at from this parable. This is true at minimum because no ideological framework, however robust, however rich, can begin to fulfill or encompass the complexity of what it is to be a human being. In this way, I think all ideologies fall short of the full experience of what it is to be human. And in that way, I find, and admittedly, I'm reading this into the parable, but I think it's there. Don't you see Jesus challenging us to dismantle the stereotypes that seem that they're probably most invisible to us, to seek them out and begin to dismantle them. This is one of the reasons that I find that I've always found Christianity to be so compelling. It's because you, in your commitment to Christianity, you are committing to an individual. And this is very unique on the stage of world religion. And I find it not only fascinating, but truly like a captivating idea. You're not actually committing to a set of ethical principles that are intractable, even though there are clearly moral and ethical commands and principles that frame the whole of the Bible. Your commitment is to a person. It's to a person, and that same commitment, that commitment to Christ, when you extend it out into loving one's neighbor, which as we understand is really everyone, we now have to encounter them first as people also. And that is a fundamental provocation. Because quite often, and understandably, our intuitions suggest that we do otherwise. Jesus takes a beloved stereotype, a vulnerable, meek, powerless, impoverished widow, and gives this stereotype a personality and a tenacity and a will that creates dissonance. This is from the Brothers Karamazov. Every one of us is undoubtedly responsible for all men and everything on earth, not merely through the general sinfulness of creation, but each one personally for all mankind and every individual man. It's too easy. It's too easy to see ourselves as ethical or unethical based on our affiliations, frankly. It's too easy. Jesus commands us, or I do think he commands it, even though he doesn't use this language directly. I think he insists that we engage in the much harder work of knowing the individual. And this is more, by the way, than simply, you know, tell me your story. It shouldn't be reduced to something like that. I mean, that has a place. And I'm not trying to, there could be a strange and unhelpful dichotomy. Like, so suddenly talking about ideas is not learning about the person, whereas talking about, like, the person's upbringing is learning about the person. I don't presume anybody here is hearing me say that, but that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that actually, I'm sorry to say, it's much harder than this. You can't understand a person simply based upon who they pledge political allegiance to. And you can't understand a person. You cannot understand a person based simply on who they, what religion they pledge their fidelity to, or how much money they make, or what categories they fall into. It's ultimately and fundamentally actually quite insulting when we think about it. It is reductionistic. How do we dismantle our stereotypes? Through the complexity of relationships. These slow us down. They humble us. And there is good news in this parable. One of the reasons to reject these parables are when they don't offer provocation, or when they don't offer something that might provide a way forward. And I do think there's a way forward here. I think this is very prescriptive. I think it's descriptive as well as prescriptive, but I think it's saying to us, there is a way to move people and to be moved. There is a way to construct better ways of looking at the world and one another. But it is a slow process, and it is a process that is constantly humbling us, and it is a process that happens through individual relationships and knowing one another. The second point, and that was the first point, within this first layer of meaning, sociological and anthropological, that was the first point, prioritize the individual over their affiliations. And finally, number two, understand the resistance against systematic oppression requires a commitment to justice over vengeance. Understand the resistance against systematic oppression requires a commitment to justice over vengeance. Here's a quote from Richard Rohr's book, Falling Upward. Before the truth sets you free, it tends to make you miserable. So much could be said about this. But there's something that really does feel good. That desire for vengeance. There's something that feels quite good about that. That desire, that need to see someone who really deserves it punished. To see that group of people who really deserves to be called out, to see them called out, to see them embarrassed, to see them hurt. This is anthropological. I mean, this is a very human impulse, not just to see the people that shouldn't be in power out of power, right? Not just to see the people that have corrupted a system, an organization, not just to see the people that misrepresent the faith called out for misrepresenting the faith. This is like there's something that is incredibly satisfying about seeing someone get theirs. You know, there's something that feels good in vengeance. But before the truth sets you free, it tends to make you miserable. If you want, my belief is that if you want to engage in the process of dismantling systemic oppression where you find it in the long term, it requires a commitment to justice. And as hard as this is, justice inherently includes compassion. It built into the fabric of justice is love, is compassion, is reconciliation, is seeing people set right. And that demands that we reevaluate the ways in which we are engaging one another and our society. And I mean, there are many thought experiments that can be helpful here. Imagine the people within your orbit that are most wrongheaded about whatever view, whatever value. I mean, what would it take to have genuine love and compassion for them? How might you begin those conversations? What kind of humbling on your part might have to take place? I mean, these are hard questions. I'll quote Levine on this. There is no easy closure to the widow's story. There's no closure at all. We cannot root for the widow or the judge, and we do not have enough information to speak about the opponent. But if he is tangled up with this widow, he may suffer guilt by association. Since we cannot find justice in the setting, we have to look elsewhere. We also have to cross-examine ourselves. What are our stereotypes of widows and judges of the legal system, and of the and its relationship to religious confession, very interesting, of human nature and the drive for vengeance. Why do we want one person or group to succeed and another to fail? Does the end ever justify the means, as in fact it does in this story, by the way? She goes on to say, Jesus was invested in fairness, reconciliation, and compassion. The parable of the widow and the judge defies any sort of fairness. The justice the unjust judge offers is not the justice of God or a program of fairness. It's granting a legal decision based not on merit, but on threat. There is no reconciliation in this parable. There is only revenge. There is no compassion, neither by the judge for the widow, nor by the widow for the judge. Point one, prioritize the individual over their affiliations. Point two, understand the resistance against systematic oppression requires a commitment to justice over vengeance. And this will conclude us today. Here's Luke chapter 6, verse 36. I just want to provide you a nice contrast with this horrible parable that is so dark. Something that's refreshing here. Luke 6, 36. Become compassionate, just as your Father is compassionate. And do not judge, and you surely shall not be judged. And do not condemn, and you surely shall not be condemned. Forgive, and you shall be forgiven. Give, and you shall be given. Into your lap they will pour a goodly measure, pressed down, shaken together, and spilling over. For in whatever measure you measure, it shall in turn be meted out to you. Center, I hope that this content is thought-provoking, as thought-provoking to you as it has been to me, and probably at times frustrating as well. This is the parable of the corrupt judge, and it's the first layer of meaning. Next week, we'll look at its commentary on authentic faith and prayer, and its commentary on the nature of God. I'll look forward to talking to you then. Blessings. Thank you.